Okay, so I mean, I realized that maybe some of the stuff I want to talk about is maybe too technical. So I'll try to say something, maybe something slightly different compared to what I was planning to say in the beginning. But okay, so let me just address all the parts of the title. So I start with this Moore-Tachikawa conjecture, which probably for physicists, it's not even a conjecture, but a true statement. But mathematically, it talks about the following thing, which for a mathematician at the first glance might seem to be something pretty bizarre. So let's consider the following category. Let me introduce the category C. So, you can do this. You can introduce it, and you can have slightly different variants of this category. So it doesn't really matter because we're going to eventually work with some very particular objects of it. But roughly speaking, the category is the following. So the category is that objects of this category are, let's say, affine algebraic groups. And again, in our setting, this will only be reductive groups. And morphisms are the following. So morphisms from, let's see, home in this category C from some G1 to G2. These are the, so now I'm going to say something slightly nasty. So these are isomorphism classes, let me say, of the following objects, of the following things, of, let's say, let me first say informally, let me write symplectic varieties with Hamiltonian G1 times G2 action. So I mean, so now you have to decipher what you mean by symplectic varieties, and somehow you can mean so you can. For the purposes of this talk, I want these guys to be affine varieties first of all. Let's see, Poisson, generically symplectic. Well, maybe normal. I'm not sure I need it for anything, but. Be normal, and when I say Hamiltonian G, it means it preserves the symplectic form, but so it also assumes that we're given a moment map. So somehow, when I say that some symplectic variety has a Hamiltonian G action, it means that moment map exists. Moreover, I mean moment map is actually slightly non-canonical, and so when I say that we're given a Hamiltonian action, what I Hamiltonian in particular means that chosen. Moment map.
So you're saying your convention is that a Hamiltonian G action means a G action.
Well, I mean, I would rather say my convention. Yeah, I mean, I'll need in a moment. I'll need the moment maps. I mean, and again, moment map is kind of defined uniquely up to shift, but somehow, but we need to choose it.
Do you mean symplectic singularities in the sense of?
Well, no. This question is somehow irrelevant. I mean, in principle, I probably should mean that, but I mean, I'm not going to define. I mean, to define the category, I also need to define, you know, composition. So this is what. I don't think I need symplectic singularity. Of course, the nice things we're going to talk about most probably. I mean, there should be symplectic singularities, and most probably in most cases, I don't know that they are. But again, I mean, this is treat this informally because somehow you can do some variance because sometimes you actually want these things to be maybe not necessarily affine but rather smooth and you know depending on the context but somehow I'm giving you sort of the idea of the category so to say but if you want you can just take it rigorously as written just to consider isomorphism classes and maybe let me make a comment I don't know how whether this kind of upgrade of what I'm going to say in a moment to which sort of will allow me to remove this word isomorphism classes. So because in a moment, so I'm going to define a structure of a category here, and the statement will be that there's a functor from this category into this category from a different category, and this different category will have a natural structure of a two category. In fact, that's here. Actually, there's also kind of a natural structure with two category, but I don't know if these two are related. So let me just say it like this. And then more. So then the only thing that we need is composition of morphisms. So how do we find composition? So composition. So we have some group G1, group G2, and group G3. And here we have some morphism, and again, morphism is given by symplectic variety with the Hamiltonian action of the product. And here we have another morphism, which is given by another variety with the product. And so, what do we do? We consider that so a composition is given by the following thing. We take the product of these two guys with the natural symplectic structure it has. And consider this Hamiltonian reduction. So by this, I'll denote Hamiltonian reduction by the diagonal copy of G2. So this thing has an action of, this whole thing has an action of G1 times G2 times G2 times G3. And so here, I consider the diagonal copy of G2. It's diagonal, and I'm reducing by that thing. So in other words, so I'm taking this, what is Hamiltonian reduction? Let me stick to affine varieties. So that means that I consider, let's say everything over complex numbers. That means that this is spec of the following thing. I take functions on sort of mu inverse of zero, mu inverse sort of x1 times x2 of zero, and here I take invariance on the G2. Well, in fact, somehow, if you want really to be careful, then somehow I need to, at least this composition is defined as everything is nice, because somehow I need to worry that this thing is reduced the way it's written, but let's assume that everything is fine, so that this is really a variety, and then it's going to have similar structure to what's written over there. So this is the composition. So the idea is that let's think about this slightly informally. So somehow, if this Hamiltonian reduction behaves nicely, at least then its composition is well defined. And the claim is that this thing forms a category. So first of all, composition is associative, and also another thing you need for a category, you need identity morphism. And so what is identity morphism from G to G? Yeah, ask the audience. Can somebody guess? So there should be it should be symplectic variety with a G cross Hamiltonian G cross G action.
Good animal.
Yes, this is the answer. This is quotangent bundle of G. So this is this is symplectic. It's endowed with two G actions, which are left and right by left and right shifts, and it has the corresponding two moment maps, and so kind of exercise show that indeed T star G is identity in the sense that if you compose it with anything else in the way defined here, you get the same thing you started. Oh, this is an easy exercise. Okay, so this is some kind of category like that. I mean, this is kind of have to be a little bit careful about sort of what you mean by symplectic varieties and so on, but let's not worry about this. So the conjecture basically, so this Murta-Chikawa, well, I don't know if I should call it a conjecture, a statement, Murta-Chikawa tell you that So I'm going to say that now that there is some functor satisfying some properties, and in fact I'm not sure that all of these properties are exactly written in Morte Chicago. Definitely most of them are. I'm not sure that actually all of them appear in Morte Chicago. But then I'm going to say that actually there exists a functor which satisfies these properties, and then I will I'll sort of sketch a construction of this functor and also say some things about it. So Morte Chicago says that there exists a functor, so given, let's say reductive group G, reductive may be connected to G, there exists a functor from the category of two vortisms to C, which sends the circle to this group G. That's kind of that's the main property. And then some other properties of this functor. So what is the category of two vortisms? So the category of two vortisms, basically, it's the category of oriented surfaces with bounds, maybe oriented two vortices. Oriented two surfaces with boundary. So what kind of properties does this thing will thing satisfy? So one other property it will satisfy is the following. So somehow kind of nicest surface is the sphere. This is S2. Where will it send the sphere? Well, it will send the sphere into the following thing. So for this, I need to introduce some notation. So given the group G, I'm going to define the following thing. I'm going to define some variety, some symplectic variety, which I'm going to call ZG. This is called the universal centralizer. And it consists of the following. So roughly speaking, this is the moduli space of pairs XG, where X is an element in the Lie algebra, and it's a regular element, not regular semisimple, but a regular element. G is an element in G, such that they commute at G of X is equal to X. And so a moduli space means we can see that this pair is up to conjugation, but you can say it actually explicitly. So explicitly inside G there is something what's called K. This is what's called the constant slice. There's some canonical piece which meets every irregular conjugacy class once. So for this, what you need, let me recall, you need to choose some principal SL2 triple. So this is EHF, this is some SL2 triple where the conjugacy class of E is a regular nilpotent conjugacy class, SL2 triple in G. And then we can see the, and then we can, then this K is equal to E plus the centralizer of F. So Z of F is the centralizer of F in G. And in fact, also, I'm going to secretly identify G with G dual. So in a G invariant way, so that I can actually think about this also as a variety, as a subvariety in G star rather. This I'll need in a moment. So far I don't need it. So somehow I can just say that this ZG, this consists of the following things. It just consists of pairs GX, where G is in G. X is in K, and they commute. And but it is actually known that this thing, so this thing doesn't have any group action, but this thing is known to have this Keras cannot. This thing is smooth, smooth, and Keras canonical symplectic structure. Keras canonical symplectic structures. In fact, maybe I'll recall in a moment where symplectic structure is coming from. But just what let me just say here that here the sphere will go to this regular centralizer.
X to be sent to X by G.
Yes, I mean it means that they commute. That's exactly means that. Okay, all right. I can write this. So this is just in fact, from this description, it's not completely trivial to how that it has a symplectic structure, but there's a different description of it, which I'll maybe will recall in a moment, which will be useful for the for future purposes. Well, and then of course another thing is where does it go? Where does the cylinder go? Well, the cylinder for the cylinder, we don't have any choice because so the cylinder must go to the quotient bundle of 2G. So note that I mean cylinder is a sphere with two punctures, so I kind of maybe might ask that from this point of view, it's kind of more natural to first talk about sphere with one puncture, and there's an explicit answer for that thing too, but it's I'll postpone. Description of that answer because somehow it's more complicated. So this explicit sphere in one function is basically the disk explicit answer for the disk. No, actually, I mean I can actually say what the answer is, but somehow again it will be maybe let me say it now. So maybe. Let's call this 1, or maybe this will be 0, this will be 1, this will be then 3, and this should be 2. And this goes to, again, I'll tell you what the variety is, but it will be the symplectic structure will not be clear, but we'll talk about the symplectic structure later. So the variety is g times, well, the same constant slice. So note that at least that it's easy to count. So that dimension of the constant slice is equal to rank of G, and dimension of G is equal to of any G is equal to rank of G plus twice the number of positive roots. So at least. If I consider this product, then at least you see that there's a that the dimension is even, which should be true. Okay, so that's another that's kind of the general piece of structure. Now the next thing, of course, should have been sphere with three punctures. And sphere with three punctures, in principle, determines everything. Sphere with three punctures plus some gluing data determines. So in principle, if you want to define such, if you want to define any functor there's one thing I didn't say. It should be kind of. Sorry, I forgot this. This functor, which is monoidal functor, and here, so this is a standard thing that on two boards. I mean, what the object this category of two boards? It's objects. Here, objects are unions of circles, and monoidal structure is just unions of these unions of circles. And here, monoidal structure. So this is also monoidal category. Category and the monoidal structures, which in a sense just sort of the tensor product of two groups in this category. This is just the usual product. So that means that in right over there, that in kind of down to earth terms, what this functor should be doing is should I, so if I have a Riemann surface with m punctures, then it, so this so if sigma is a Riemann surface whose boundary has let's say n components, then to this we're supposed to associate some variety, some symplectic variety x. Symplectic variety x with an action, or Hamiltonian action, of g to the n. So in particular, we should do this for a sphere with n punctures. But again, sort of the standard yoga here is that if you know how to do for a sphere with three punctures, then you need some an additional. That sort of determines everything. So somehow you also need some gluing data, which is almost a property of the situation. So somehow, but sort of the main thing is sort of to say where the sphere with three punctures goes. And so here, somehow, funny thing happens. So somehow, there should be some kind of canonical variety for any reductive group with an action of g cubed. And it turns out it's very difficult to describe it explicitly. So I only know an explicit answer for SL2 and SL3. And for instance, I don't know an explicit answer for SL4. And I think this explicit answer was also more than Chicago, probably.
Sasha?
Yes?
Can I interpret your answer for the disk as saying that, like, when I fill in a puncture, that's the same as doing reduction for n there?
Yes. Actually, yes. Yeah. The this is actually true, yes.
I like that answer better.
Yeah, and, well, actually, if you go from, that's actually true. In fact, if you go from, both if you go, when you go from here to here and from here to here, this actually what happens. So, I was going to say this later. So, and in fact, somehow, this is actually not in Monte Chicago, and I don't know, but let me see, I know this, if you can see the sphere with, I'm not sure that this is actually. I'm not sure this is always true. I mean, this is true if you consider sphere with some number of punctures, then this is true. Whether this should be true always, this is actually not completely.
I mean, multiplying by the constant slice and then reducing by n, not the same as just reducing by n.
Ah, okay. No, you're right. Okay.
It's always the same.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this later. So somehow, maybe number four is that if you can see the sphere with three punctures, sorry, then this thing goes to some unknown stuff, and this, and you know, I'll tell you later the answer for SL2 and SL3. But let me just say this essentially, term is over. So my goal is to tell you the construction of this thing. So I'm actually I will tell you what the answer is, and then I'm also, in the case when G is SLN, I'll also talk about relationship of this thing with some Coulomb branches, which actually allows to make some computations. I was going to sort of prove that the answer that I was going to give you is the right answer, but really that's maybe a little bit technical, so I'll probably skip that. But okay. Yeah, maybe before I go into this, since this will be needed in any case, let me make two remarks. One remark is that since, you know, I'm probably, maybe David should do it instead of me, but I just want to say that somehow in the physics language, where is this stuff coming from? So this thing, this variety X, I mean, so if I can see the, this, maybe I'll go over here. So if I can see the, if you look here, then this variety X is actually, this is actually a Higgs branch of certain three-dimensional quantum field theory. And this Higgs branch is, well, at least maybe, well, let me, for simplicity, assume, let me assume G is simple and AD type. So simple and simply laced. Then what this thing is, it's the following. So this three-dimensional theory, this is the way it's constructed is that you take this a standard six-dimensional how's it called, zero-two theory, and compactify it, and then compactify on S1 times sigma, so you get some 3D theory, with the right amount. So this is for, with n equal 4 supersymmetry, and this thing is this Higgs branch, and then somehow from this point of view, it's actually not very difficult to argue that these things should form this functor. And again, forming this functor means that somehow the main thing you should prove is that composition really corresponds to some Hamiltonian reduction. And composition means that you glue two surfaces along some components of the boundary. And you want to prove that this corresponds to some Hamiltonian reduction. And again, in this language, it's kind of not very difficult to see this. But somehow, sort of the challenge was to do it mathematically. So, okay. So this is one remark I want to make. The other remark, let me make it here. So this was really about this Poisson-Whitaker reduction. So one thing that one can do, so I suppose that we have X variety with G action. So it's electric variety. G action, then we can perform Hamiltonian reduction effects with respect to G, but we can actually perform Hamiltonian reduction effects with respect to some subgroups of G. And in particular, let M inside G be a maximal unipotent subgroup. Unipotent. And so let chi from N to C be a non-degenerate homomorphism so that means that this n, if it quotient n by its commutator, this more or less canonically is equal to sum over alpha I, which is simple roots, or maybe I should say here simple coroots, some sort of C alpha I, so this is a one-dimensional additive groups in which the torus, so here we can also take a torus, a maximal torus, which normalizes M, and then this torus will act on each of these by multiplying by the corresponding root. And so non-degenerate means that we want it to be non-trivial on each, non-zero on each summoned, and that of course induces homomorphism from its Lie algebra. So I'll denote it by the same letter from to C. This is just one-dimensional Lie algebra, and then we can form this Poisson-Whitaker reduction of X. This is just the reduction of X with respect to this group and this character. So it means that we take the pre-image of the mole and moment map only with respect to M, or with respect to group N, and take the preimage of this character chi, and take quotient by M. This is called Poisson-Whitaker reduction of X. And so, for example, What happens is that this centralizer here, this cost of Whittaker reduction with respect to, so let me just state it. This universal centralizer can show that it's obtained in the following way. You take this cotangent bundle to G, and then you perform, so this has two G actions. So this cost of Whittaker with respect to G, but you can, let's take Coston Whittaker with respect to G times G. So it means that we somehow perform this Coston Whittaker reduction both with respect to left action of N and with respect to right action of N. So in fact, it's kind of slightly nicer to here use, to choose kind of positive barrel and negative barrel, use positive barrel here and negative barrel here, but it doesn't really matter. So this, you can show that this is such a natural isomorphism, and this particularly constructs your symplectic structure on the left-hand side. And also this thing, this G times times K, you can actually identify it with really with Coston Whittaker G, just only one copy of G, let's say right copy of G, of T star G. In fact, yes, and so and then from what's written here, it shows that if you consider so here you're kind of you're losing this right action of G, but the left action of G is still there, and then so this construction, this thing actually as a variety, as a symplectic variety again with G action, and then if you perform its Coston Whittaker reduction again with respect to G of this guy, then you get this universal centralizer. Again, as a symplectic variety with no group action. And so as Ben said, so this kind of implies that this implies that always filling in a hole, that was gluing, so if you have some Riemann surface with punctures, so if you want to glue a disk if you want to fill one hole with a disk, then filling a hole corresponds to the Coston Whittaker reduction. It's kind of a nice property, which somehow I think that, I mean, I don't know if there's a way to see it in this language.
Well, there's a physical statement that should imply that.
I mean, I don't know how you see this Coston Whittaker reduction in that language. I'm not even suggesting to discuss it now, but I think that I would be glad if somebody could explain it to me. Okay. Yeah, and maybe just to tell you that things. That if you want to sort of understand this thing for a sphere with three punctures, the things very quickly start getting non-trivial. Maybe erase this. So just example, you consider what goes to sphere with three punctures, what corresponds to sphere with three punctures, then so if you consider so this goes to where? So now, so if G is SL2, then the answer is extremely simple. Then the answer is that this question mark is equal to C2 tensor C2 tensor C2 with a natural action of three copies of SL2 and natural action of natural symplectic form. Now, if G is SL3, then this thing turns out to be the following. It turns out to be the closure of the minimal nilpotent orbit in E6. And well, at least this is symplectic. Well, I mean, kind of singular symplectic, but it's maybe exercise. Invent a Hamiltonian action of SL3 cubed on, well, on this. So maybe I say that somehow if you can see this Dynkin diagram of E6, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then this thing obviously contains a product of two SL3s. So it contains, if you can see this SL3 and, you know, this subdiagram, this diagram, these are both correspond to SL3s, and they, you know, they're not linked, so they commute with each other. So that gives a connection of two copies of SL3. So exercise is invent a third one which commutes with these two. So let me, I mean, again, I can do it, but it will be, again, maybe somewhat technical. But I mean, the only point of this, I mean, there are two points in bringing up this example is that, first of all, I'll kind of mention later. So I'm going to present some point of view on the subject, and I'm going to mention somehow where you can see this stuff appearing. And third, somehow, but right now, somehow, the main reason for bringing this up is that sort of to tell you that things really getting somewhat non-trivial. And for instance, if G is SL4, that I don't know. Okay, any questions? So now let me kind of switch gears and explain a construction. So on the construction, so this construction is actually so construction so in fact it's due to a combination, so it's due to Ginzburg-Kasdan and well, plus some student of Ginzburg whose name is Bapa. And so we kind of rediscovered this construction in a slightly different way. So somehow, so in fact, the proof that this construction works that's written in our paper is actually slightly different. That's what's written over there, although not completely unrelated. But one other thing is that what I'll try to say is that if G is indeed G is of type A, so G is SLN or GLN, then there actually, let me say it like this, there's another construction. There's, well, identically the same, but there's a slightly different way to look at this construction. Different way of looking at it, which is turns out to be somewhat suitable for calculations. For instance, this is how we can see that this answer is correct. Okay, now let me explain the construction. Now to explain the construction, I really have to switch gears, and this is where the affine Grassmannian is going to appear. And I'll also need to change the notation. So now, so I'm going to make a change of notation, which will be the following. I'm just going to switch the roles of the group G and its Langmuir dual. So use. We're going to fix a reductive group G, and by doing something with this reductive group, we'll actually construct. The sought for functor construct the sought for functor by for G check, which is the Langmuir dual. questions? Comments? Okay. Well,
you didn't simply list at any point.
No, for what I'm going to say now, it's absolutely irrelevant. I don't actually know any explicit non-trivial calculations in the non-simply least case. In fact, I don't know any, apart from the case of SL2 and SL3, I don't know any non-trivial calculations at all. So, actually, unless this theory is mirror dual to some quiver theory, I don't know I don't know any way to compute the answer. okay, so in the construction, so now we can say that the affine Grassmannian of G, this is this quotient G of T, G squared brackets of T, and this is also the same as moduli space of principle. G bundles on, say, D, which is the formal disk, plus trivialization on the formal puncture disk, and so, in fact, so we're going to study. Let's call this, let's introduce notation O, which is the ring of formal Taylor series. So we're going to study unfortunately I have to say this, some kind of equivariant derived category of constructible sheaves on this affine Grassmann. So appropriately defined, somehow there's some kind of infinities have to deal with, but let me ignore this. So it's a kind of known fact that this category carries a canonical monoidal structure, actually symmetric monoidal structure. In fact, I'll tell you a little later what this category is, I mean, sort of explicit terms, symmetric monoidal structure. And so if one way to construct, want to construct some affine varieties, in particular want to construct some commutative algebras, which will be their algebras of functions. And so one way to construct such algebras, which might be a very peculiar way, but still somehow, is that if, so given, so this monoidal structure is called convolution sheaves. And so given an object, let me call A in this category, it makes sense to say that A is a ring object. And that means that we're given so a morphism from A, convolution A to A. This is a multiplication map, which satisfies some standard properties. Which satisfies some standard properties, for example, associativity, and so on. So, and there's also, by the way, the unit object here is, so inside this thing, there's an image of point one, and so if, the skyscraper sheaf at this point, this is the unit object. And so this should be a unit, which is a map from that unit object into this guy. And this would be some associativity and so on. So somehow, so it makes sense to talk about ring objects, and because this symmetric monoidal structure, so somehow we can also talk about commutative ring objects. So what we're going to do is, so let me actually again stick to the case. So what I'm going, so to explain the construction. So I'm actually going to tell you what is the construction for a sphere with some number of punctures, and then somehow. I mean, again, even if I just tell you what is the answer for a sphere with three punctures, that sort of determines the rest uniquely if you can check some kind of gluing axiom. So somehow I'm even going to tell the answer for a sphere with arbitrary number of punctures, and then you have to check this gluing axiom, which I'm probably not going to do on the blackboard. That's exactly the technical part that I originally wanted to do, but I decided that it is too technical, but. Nonetheless, I wanted to tell you the sort of flavor of things. So I'm going to tell the answer. So the idea is that given some integer n greater or equal than zero, we're going to construct some ring object an in this category endowed with an action of g check to the n. And then the cohomology, and then this algebra of functions on sort of, okay, let me introduce an addition, let xn.
What does it mean for an object in this category to be endowed with an action?
I'm sorry? No, this is just endowed with an action in this case, so just biotomorphism, so just the group. So I'll give you an example. So I'll tell you precisely what this object is for. I'm sorry?
That's on the sheaf.
Yeah, it acts on the sheaf, yes. I'll tell you what this thing is in a moment for n equal to 1. I mean, even for first of all, for n equal to 0, I'll tell you what it is. But and then I'll tell you what it is for n equal to 1. So let x be the image of sphere with n punctures under my functor, under this Murta-Chikawa functor. So the idea is that the ring of functions on this xn is going to be the cohomology, well, maybe GFO equivariant of this object an, which I'm going to describe. Well, maybe it's not a good, let me put a sub n just to distinguish it from like nth power. Okay, let me actually. Explain this. Well, okay, the basic thing is the following. So, well, let me recall that inside. So I have this derived category, grand sheaves of affine Grassmannian. Inside, I have the corresponding category of Pavlov sheaves. And usually, those guys will not be Pavlov, but there will be one case, namely for an n equal to 1, and only in that case, this thing will be Pavlov. And the category of Pavlov sheaves is, you know, is. Naturally equivalent to the category of representations of G-check. That's called geometric Satake isomorphism. So how does it work? So somehow we have lambda, which is a domain. So recall that the affine Grassmannian is the union of some, is joint union of some orbits of the group G of O, which we denote by Girl lambda. So this is G of O orbits, and if I have some where lambda runs over lambda plus, where lambda is the weight lattice of G check, and lambda plus inside is a dominant weight. And so if I have lambda in lambda plus, then we can form the corresponding representation view of lambda, which is reducible representation with highest weight lambda. And that thing corresponds to IC sheaf, well, to what I'll call IC lambda, which is the intersection cohomology sheaf of the closure of this thing. And so this is kind of known to be fine dimensional. These closures are for some fine dimensional projective varieties, but singular. And well, that's how this equivalence works. So now what we're going to do is the following. So we're going to, so this A sub 1 is going to be, so this is, let me denote this functor somehow. This, let me call it S. This is S for Satake. So this is S inverse of the regular representation. Explicitly, this thing is equal to summation over all lambda in lambda plus of what? Of IC lambda tensor V of lambda dual. And this is this thing is an equivalence of monoidal categories. So in particular, in the regular representation, you know, this is just functions on the group. So this is a ring. So therefore, under this equivalence, this regular representation is actually a ring object in the category of representations of G-check. So therefore, this guy is going to be a ring object in here, in particular, ring object in here. It's already a funny question to say what happens when you, now this equivalence, the way it works is that actually, on the, I mean, if you want to construct this functor, then given the sheaf, you're supposed to construct a vector space with a G-check action. And constructing the vector space without a G-check action is actually very easy. Namely, so the way this equivalence works is that, so if you have some F in, which is this perverse sheaf, then if you consider Satake of F, then as a vector space, it is just the cohomology of this F on the Grassmannian. But here, what we're saying is that if you want to construct the coordinate ring of that X sub 1, what we need is we need to consider the equivariant cohomology of this guy. So we know that the ordinary cohomology of this guy is just a regular representation of G-check. But here we need to construct the equivariant cohomology. And if you we need to look at the equivariant cohomology. And and this equivariant cohomology is actually going to be a module over the equivariant cohomology of a point. And it's actually easy to believe that it's going to be a free module. So somehow the fact that the result is, so that the result, I mean, the result will be some ring, and this will be a ring of functions. So here I claim that this was a ring of functions G times the Coastland slice. The Coastland slice, you know, as a, well, as an abstract variety, it's just isomorphic to T mod W, where T is the Cartan subalgebra in G, and W is the Weyl group. And functions of this is also the same as equivariant cohomology of a point. So the fact that we get this as the answer is not super surprising. Somehow. But you can check that in this case, that's what you get. But what's more interesting is what do you do for arbitrary n here? And for arbitrary n, what you do is the following. And now I said that this thing is let me just make one remark about this. So somehow here, What I'm saying is that if we start with the perverse sheaf, if we consider this cohomology, then this cohomology carries a canonical G-check action. So here, that has nothing to do with the G-check action that we want over there. Namely, here, just on this sheaf itself, there is an action of G-check, which just here acts. I mean, in this description, it just acts every time on the second multiple. It does nothing here. So we just consider so there's an action of G-check on this sheaf by automorphisms of the sheaf. And therefore, if we take its cohomology, covariant cohomology, whatever, any if we apply any kind of natural operation to this sheaf, we're going to get something which will have a G-check action. That's the one we use. So in particular here, for instance, if you remove this stuff, then you see, well, if you just look at this thing by itself, then somehow it has actually two G-check actions. Because, I mean, you know, it's a product, so it has left and right G-check action. But only, I mean, but that's kind of an accident. And the accident is that, because in this case, somehow this obtained as cohomology of some, well, covariant cohomology of some perverse sheaf. And in general, those guys will be non-perverse. So somehow here we just get this additional action is coming from the fact that somehow cohomology of a perverse sheaf is endowed with a G-check action by itself. But that's kind of, but that thing applies only to perverse sheaves, and somehow this almost never happens otherwise. Okay, now let me tell you the answer. And again, maybe it's, I mean, unfortunately, it's a nice kind of argument why this answer sort of satisfies all the requirements. But let me see, answer for AN. But unfortunately, it's too technical. The answer is the following. So again. If, even that answer is probably maybe too technical for the audience, but let me nonetheless say it. So somehow, when we consider sheaves, constructible sheaves on any variety, there's a notion of tensor product of these sheaves. And maybe let me say it here. So somehow, if let's say Y is any variety over C, then given F and G two constructible sheaves or constructible complexes of sheaves, you can form the tensor product. There's a notion of tensor products of sheaves, which is kind of natural notion of tensor product, can form this. But there's a slightly different version of this. But also, there's another also there's another tensor product, which I'll denote like this. And so the kind of formal definition is the following. So somehow, actually, what is tensor product? So one way, so if you consider F and G, you can consider their exterior product. And this is going to be, and this is easy to define, this is a sheaf on X cross, on Y cross Y. So this is sort of a sheaf which is sort of F in the first variable and G in the second variable. And now you can also consider the diagonal embedding of Y into Y. And it's easy to see that the usual definition of tensor product of sheaves is the following. It's the inverse image, star inverse image of this F box times G. But for constructible sheaves, there's also a notion of sort of inverse image with compact support. There's a notion of shriek inverse image. And so this is what this thing is. Now, maybe one better explanation, at least for some people here, is that this is also the only tensor product which makes sense for D modules. Especially if you consider not necessarily holonomic D modules, but all D modules, then this is also the natural. So somehow you can think about the category of constructible sheaves as equivalent to derived category of constructible sheaves equivalent to the category of D modules with regular singularities, and for D modules there's a natural tensor product, and under this equivalence, which is called Riemann-Hilbert correspondence, it goes over to this one. Also, the natural tensor product. So finally, the answer here is that this An is equal to this A1 tensor product with shriek A1 where this you take this m times. So this thing is not a perverse sheaf anymore. Moreover, so what happens here? If you do it this way, then you might ask what happens when n is equal to zero. And when n is equal to zero, then usually somehow when you take some power, and this is like some kind of nth tensor power. So if one took a zero of tensor power, then it means that usually zero of power is equal to one. So it means that you should get zero of tensor power is always equal to the unit object, but it should be equal to the unit object with respect to this monoidal structure. And what is the unit object with respect to this monoidal structure? Well, this is general on any variety. It's called a dualizing sheaf. So A zero is equal to the dualizing sheaf of the Grassmannian, and so in particular, now in general, somehow on any Y, let me write it here. On any Y, there's a notion of dualizing sheaf, and so if you have any sheaf, well, let's seek fine dimensional varieties. So if you have any sheaf, any complex of sheaves, we can form its cohomology, and we can also form its cohomology with compact support. If you consider any Y, then its cohomology with compact support, if you consider this dualizing sheaf, its cohomology with compact support is called homology of Y. This is actually the only definition of homology that I can understand. And its cohomology without compact support is called Borel-Moore homology of Y. So what I wanted to say is that, well, in the fine Grassmannian, it's actually, well, proper or improper, it's actually union of projective varieties. So on the fine Grassmannian, it doesn't really matter if we do cohomology or cohomology with compact support. And there, so in particular, we see that the coordinate ring of X0 is supposed to be equal to the homology, well, G of O equivariant. Homology. G of O equivariant homology of the affine Grassmannian, and that thing is known to be the algebra of functions on this universal centralizer for G-check, actually, that I described before. So this is the theorem. This is an old theorem of Bezrukavnikov, Finkelberg, and Mirkovich. So by the way, this guy, this dualizing sheaf, is already very much non-perverse. So in particular, when we consider its cohomology, we don't get any G-check action there. And you know, indeed, this has nothing like G-check action. Okay, so maybe I'll just So a particularly funny thing here, but it happens when you take n equal to 2. So if n is equal to 2, so it means that you consider this A1 tensor with itself just once. And what I'm saying is that if I consider this G of O equivariant cohomology of this guy, this is equal to the algebra of functions on the cotangent bound of the G-check. And again, so the only thing which is kind of which should be clear here is that this thing does have two G-check actions. I mean, one coming from just this multiple, the other coming from this multiple, and this will go over to left and right action here. Yeah, and maybe another thing is that this is kind of standard game in this business. So why is this thing symplectic or Poisson always? Well, anytime. So the point is that it actually comes with the canonical quantization, and so this. Let me erase this. So this. C of xn. So this object, it's not just equivariant with respect to G of O, but it has a natural structure of G of O times C star equivariant object. And so, so in fact, this C of xn has a canonical quantization, which is the cohomology equivariant respect to slightly bigger group. And this, the equivariant parameter for this group is the quantization parameter. The same. Yeah. Okay, maybe last thing I'm going to say is what does this thing have to do with Coulomb branches? Let me do it for g equal to gln. So the claim is that, and again, maybe from physics this claim was kind of expected, but here you need to prove it mathematically. So here, maybe I'll refer to Ben's talk last week, that so together with Finkenbeck and Nakajima, we defined, kind of gave a mathematical definition of something which should be the Coulomb branch of some three-dimensional gauge theories of quotientian type. In particular, one way to construct such a thing is that suppose you have a quiver. Let's put orientation in this quiver. So we can actually g gauge, some gauge group, g gauge, this, which is going to be some reductive group, and n, this is a representation of g gauge. One can construct the some kind of variety, affine variety MC. This is some affine single symplectic variety. Which is constructed, whose algebra function is constructed as homology of something, which is Borel Moore homology of something, not exactly of the affine Grassmannian, but something which has to do with the affine Grassmannian. And let me just say that kind of standard example is that if we start with a quiver, so this is a quiver Q, so I is the set of vertices, and you choose some dimension vectors, you choose some dimension vectors V and W in Z greater or equal than I. Then we choose some vector spaces vi of dimension little vi and wi of dimension little wi. Then we can construct this g gauge, which is going to be product over all I and I of gl of vi. And you can see the representation n, which is direct sum over all edges, I goes to j, here you write home from vi to vj, and plus direct sum over all I, home from vi to wi, which has a natural action with g gauge. And so, and there's some technique of how you can, well, for sufficiently nice quivers, there's some technique how you can actually compute such things. And for finite and affine quivers of ADE type, the corresponding varieties, the Coulomb branches have been computed. And so now one theory I want to formulate, unfortunately, I don't know when I'm supposed to stop, but I'm saying that if G is GLM, let's say, then XM is the Coulomb branch of the quiver theory which were for some star-shaped quiver. Which looks like this. So here, where, okay, so star shape means that we have some, you know, central vertex and some legs. And so here, the number little n is the number of legs. And so here, sort of essentially this number n is the length of each leg. And the only other thing that you need is the dimension vector, and the dimension vector here looks like this. So in fact, here you don't need a frame. I mean, the framing will be zero. This W will be zero. So somehow you take this n minus one here, n minus two, and so on up to one. And you take this thing on each leg.
N tuples of four flags? No, not quite.
No, it's just that's somehow the point. Well, first of all, see, even for when you have just one leg, then what happens is that if this guy were, I always forget. I mean, you probably remember this in this Quiver annotation. This, you know, some verses are denoted by, you know, with a circle, some with a square. I mean,
These are circles.
So if you do something like this, if you do like 1, 2, 3, 4, and then n minus one, and then n, then this thing is that thing would be something like quotient bundle of flag variety. Maybe it's image deformation. So I'll do some kind of flavor thing. But actually, here we're doing not that. We're doing this.
So you get the symplectic reduction.
Well, but that thing is also this. I mean, in this case the, I mean, this is also the same as the quotient bundle of quotient bundle of GLN. This is not the contingent bundle of G. No, sorry, this is not the contingent bundle of GLN. This is one leg. So this is not the contingent bundle of GLN. This is this thing I told you before. This is G times the constant slice. This is what you get. As a variety, this Kerponian Coulomb branch, well, in this case, will be G times the constant slice, where G is SLN. I'm confused of whether this is SLN or G. I think GLN. Here you get this variety will be just GLN times CN. With some subjective structure. So, okay, I probably should, stop now. So the idea is that this is the thing that sort of allows you to make these calculations I told you before for SL2 and SL3. Well, and for SL2, and if you want to go to SLN from, if you want to go from GLN to SLN, then always the rule is that you have to perform the Hamiltonian reduction with respect to central C star. And maybe let me finish by saying one thing. So, this theorem actually follows from the following thing, which is not very difficult to prove, but I'm still kind of amazed that it works. Let's consider. So this, let me remind you that this Coulomb branch is defined in the following way. There's some in scheme R, G, H, N that you define here, and then the scheme consists of the following pairs. It consists of, well, it first of all maps to the affine Grassmannian of G, H. And so it consists of, let's see, P, which is a principal G bundle on the disk, some kappa, which is a trivialization of P on D star. And then one additional piece of data is some kind of what we call phi. This is a section of the associated vector bundle on D, which, so to say, has no pole with respect to kappa. That means that if you use kappa to make it a section of the trivial bundle, then on D star, then it has no pole at zero. And so you can define for any group in any representation. And moreover, of course, if your gauge group is a product of some groups, then you can project it not necessarily to the full Grassmannian, but only to the sum of the factors. So the unfortunately, my n here placed. Maybe let me call this. Let me make this n different from this n. This is very easy to do in tech, but so now if we look at this thing, then here we can project this. We take g gauge, which is the product of GLI, I from 1 to n. And we take this RGN in this case, and we project it to the affine Grassmann. Yeah, and so maybe let me call it the algebra of functions on the Coulomb branch. This is the equivariant G gauge of all equivariant Borel-Moore homology of this guy. And so here the claim is that if we consider this thing, and if we take n to be this direct sum of Holm from ci to ci plus 1, this goes from I from 0 to n minus 1. Then then the claim is that if you consider this map, let's call it pi from R G gauge n to just define Grassmannian of GLN, then the claim is that if we take the direct image of the dualizing sheaf of this guy, we get this perverse sheaf A1. It's actually a very strange statement because somehow, well, I mean, you can actually sort of say it more precisely, just saying what corresponds to what. But the point is that this perverse sheaf somehow it has this guy is written as a huge direct sum. And so first of all, it's a direct sum over this. So there's a direct sum over this dominant weights lambda, and it's absolutely unclear how to see it from here. So the fact that this actually has a lot of connected components, but these connected components correspond to the way. I mean, this thing also is supposed to have an action of the group GLN, and if you consider its weight decomposition with respect to this group GLN, it corresponds to connected components of this thing. But even if you specialize yourself to some particular connected component, this thing is still supposed to have a huge direct sum decomposition with respect to dominant weights of GLN. And this is very hard to see explicitly, but that's kind of the theorem which we proved. So this is this isomorphism, and this isomorphism very easily imply this actually for any little n. And this what allows you to make calculations in some case. So for instance, this calculation that for SL3 with free punctures, you get this minimal nilpotent orbit in E6. The only way how I know how to perform this calculation mathematically rigorously is to go through all this. And in this case, just let me say where maybe the last thing I'll say. So where to see C6 from? Well, if you consider the SL3 case, GN3 and SL3 are kind of closely related. So the point is that there, what happens is that this quiver you get looks like this. So this is actually affine E6. So somehow it's so it's in a fine it's a quiver gauge theory for quiver for a fine quiver E6. So somehow the fact that E6 has something to do with the answer is not that surprising. I mean, if I have to work a little bit more to produce exactly the answer that I explained, but this is really getting too technical. Okay, maybe let me just finish by saying that this, the summary is that there's this kind of, again, a mathematically pretty strange conjecture of Warren and Chicago, which says that somehow this should be the spanoidal function from two bordisms to this category of symplectic varieties with G action. And then you can actually first of all prove that such a function really exists. Sort of, you can construct it, and at least for a sphere with any number of punctures, you can construct the algebra of functions on the corresponding variety in this way. Then again, so this C of Xn, let me write it. This is the equivariant cohomology on the Grassmannian of this sheaf An. And you can actually work a little bit more. You can construct these sheaves for any surface, not necessarily for genus zero surface, but it's just notationally slightly more complicated. But you can actually construct a ring object for any here in for any surface with any number of functions, which should probably also be expected from physical considerations. But I'm not the right person to talk about this. So you can construct these guys like this, and even for arbitrary surfaces, you can construct them by sort of somewhat similar procedure. And then in type A, there is a different interpretation of this thing. And this different interpretation sometimes allows you to make calculations. Okay, I think I should stop here.
In type A, I mean, you're supposed to have, like in the thing you drew, you're supposed to have four GLN actions on the Coulomb branch, right?
Four? Why four?
Four?
No, I mean, four, this was like for an example. Four is little n.
Yes.
I mean,
absolutely. So, but is that visible from the quiver you draw? Is it easy to figure out group action?
No, not really. No. Even I said that for. So, for instance, if you take this SL3 example, or, well, JL3 example, when you take this minimal orbit, the minimal orbit you get when you consider SL3, otherwise, you get something which is essentially this minimal orbit times C2. So, I mean, for GL3, you'll get minimal orbit times C2, and for SL3, you'll get action. It's like this minimal orbit times C2, this is exactly the Uhlenbeck space of rank 3 instantons on C2. This is. But, okay, let's. In any case, so I want to say if you can see this minimal orbit for E6, the fact that it has. SL3 cubed action is not, well, not absolutely not clear, but somehow it's not completely clear how to see that. No, I mean, I don't think that. It's kind of an additional. The way you construct it is somewhat as follows. You actually. Inside this algebra of functions on the Coulomb branch, you find some elements which, if you consider Poisson brackets with these elements, it generates the corresponding Lie algebra. And then you prove that this action is integrable. So this is sort of the construction. Okay. But somehow, no, but see, from, I told you that from, I, where is it written? So I told you this fact. This, I mean, the point is that once you know this, you can write a very similar formula for any n. And from that formula, it becomes clear because somehow, see, then the point is that originally Coulomb branch is the cohomology of this dualizing sheaf. But the point is that, so let's actually look at this example. So what happens here is that if you consider the cohomology of, well, Bremer homology of this, and you can see the cohomology of dualizing sheaf, a priori, it doesn't have any GLN action. But the claim is that when you push it forward here, already here it acquires this geo-dimension. So it becomes a priori some kind of freeing object here. This is actually also this is some abstract nonsense. But the claim is that this freeing object is not something, but so first of all, it's perverse, which is actually a miracle. Such thing almost never happens. But not only it is perverse, but also, I mean, if it is perverse, then we can ask what corresponds to this thing under Sataka equivalence. What corresponds to it, if you show that what corresponds to it is the regular representation. So in particular, there's an action of the group here. So basically, the idea is that once you know this, then there's a very similar formula which says that if you consider this star-shaped quiver, then you can see the same push forward. You can see the push forward to GLN corresponding to this vertex. Then you get this guy. And in particular, this guy sort of by construction is endowed with an action of little n copies of GLN. This is kind of how you see the action. But what I'm trying to say is that it's enough to prove it for this one. So it's once you prove it for this one, the fact that for arbitrary little n the same thing holds is absolutely automatic. So this is just some kind of base change isomorphism. But if you just ask me about this quiver thing, so for instance, if you can see the star-shaped quiver, but maybe with different numbers here, I have no idea what acts there. And again, sort of this action from the this Coulomb branch point of view, somehow it's the action of the Lie algebra is given by just Poisson break of some particular functions, which you can write explicitly actually, but somehow.
Okay. Let's next session.